Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
A mother walks into a neonatal unit to visit her premature son. He had been stable, gaining weight. The doctors had been cautiously optimistic. She finds a nurse standing over his incubator. And hours later, her baby is gone. Prosecutors would later allege in a case that consumed the British legal system for years that the child died from air deliberately injected into his bloodstream. And they would allege that the nurse standing over his incubator was the one who did it. The mother walked into what she believed was the safest room in the hospital, according to the prosecutor's case at trial. She walked into a crime scene she could not recognize. This is the story of the Countess of Chester Hospital's neonatal unit, a place built to protect the most fragile human beings on the planet. And the year that unit became, according to the verdict of a jury, a killing ground. The case of Lucy Letby has divided a nation, launched a public inquiry, triggered the arrest of hospital executives, and raised a question that still does not have a clean answer. Did a quiet, career-focused nurse take the lives of 7 babies in her care? Or did a broken system produce a wrongful conviction? This is the first of 5 episodes on the Lucy Letby case, because a story with this many layers cannot be told in one sitting. Over the next 4 episodes, 5 including this one, we're going to walk through how the hospital silenced its own doctors, how the prosecution built a conviction, and why that conviction is now being challenged by medical experts around the world, and where the reckoning stands as of this recording. Before we do any of that, though, you need to understand what happened inside that ward. And as we do this, I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through this case. The Countess of Chester Hospital is not a major teaching hospital. It is a small district hospital in Northwest England, the kind of place that serves its surrounding community quietly and without national attention. Its neonatal unit handled premature and critically ill newborns, a high-stakes environment, even under the best circumstances. The unit was not required to handle the most complex cases. Those would typically be transferred to larger, more regional centers like Liverpool Women's Hospital. We have the same sort of things in the United States. Small, more localized hospitals in a tinier community typically don't handle more complex cases. You're going to move her to the bigger city, more experts, more care, better options for that care than maybe a smaller hospital could provide. Same sort of dynamic works, you know, basically everywhere. But for the babies, it did admit the unit was the difference between life and death. Babies in neonatal intensive care exist on a razor's edge almost anywhere. Their lungs may not be fully developed. Their immune systems are virtually non-existent. Their organs are still learning to function outside the womb. A complication that would be minor to a full-term infant can be fatal to a baby born weeks too early. The staff who work these units carry an emotional weight that most people never think about. Every shift is a negotiation between medicine and chance, between what the human body can endure and what it cannot. Lucy Letby joined the Countess of Chester neonatal unit in 2012. After completing her nursing degree at the University of Chester, she was born in Hereford in January of 1990. She was an only child raised by a furniture salesman and an accounts clerk. Colleagues described her as quiet, dedicated, and focused. Friends said she had known since childhood that she wanted to work with babies. That nursing was not just a career choice, but something closer to an identity. She earned a Band 5 qualification. What does that mean? Well, it means it meant she was cleared to care basically for the sickest of infants in the intensive care section for the unit. So she was someone who was more qualified than most. For 3 years, nothing appeared out of the ordinary. She took extra shifts. She volunteered for overtime. She was well-liked by many of her nursing colleagues, though some consultants would later note a pattern of behavior at the time that did not raise alarms. She was, by most external measures, exactly the kind of nurse you would want looking after your newborn. And she took salsa dance classes in her free time and seemed, by every visible standard, unremarkable. Really just a normal, average nurse. Getting by in life. Young. Figuring out her role, figuring out her path. Figuring out her own identity. Then in June of 2015, the death rate inside that neonatal unit spiked in a way the hospital had never experienced. The number of infant deaths in a single two-week stretch equaled the entire total for the previous year. Babies who had been stable deteriorated without warning. Infants who should have survived didn't, and the collapses kept coming. What prosecutors laid out at trial was a pattern so disturbing that it's difficult to absorb, even in summary. This was not a single event. According to the prosecution, it was a sustained campaign of harm carried out over 12 months against the most defenseless patients in the building. It began with Child A. That's how they named all the kids. Different letters, Child A, B, C, D. We're going to talk about them. Born 6 weeks premature, the baby died within 90 minutes of Letby coming on shift for the night. Prosecution alleged the infant was injected with air. Injected with air. The very next day, Child A's twin, Child B, collapsed after a sudden drop in heart rate. The baby survived after resuscitation. Two babies from the same family, consecutive days, according to the prosecution, both attacked by the same nurse. That's the allegation. Within days, Child C, a premature baby boy, was dead. Prosecutors allege Lepi had introduced air into his stomach through a nasogastric tube. Then Child D, a full-term baby girl, died 36 hours after birth. Three infant deaths in 2 weeks. That was as many as the entire previous year. The case of Child E is one that stays with you. According to the prosecution, Child E's mother walked into the neonatal unit during what was allegedly an active attack. Air was being injected into the baby's bloodstream. Prosecutors alleged at trial the mother did not realize what she was seeing. She saw a nurse. She saw her baby. She did not know that, according to the prosecution's case. She was witnessing the final moments of her son's life. Child E died. His twin brother, Child F, survived after being injected with the insulin he did not need. According to prosecutors, the insulin caused a dangerous crash in blood sugar levels, but medical staff intervened in time. And there was Child G, attacked twice, according to prosecutors, including through air injected by a nasal gastric feeding tube. Child G survived, but the damage was catastrophic and permanent. The baby was left with quadriplegic cerebral palsy, a condition requiring round-the-clock care for the rest of that child's life. An entire future erased in an instant, allegedly at the hands of the person entrusted with that infant's safety. One of the parents of a surviving victim later testified that their child suffered irreversible brain damage. That child will never walk, never speak normally, never live independently. That is the cost, measured in a single life, of what allegedly happened inside that ward. Through the fall of 2015 and early 2016, the pattern continued. Child I, a premature baby girl, died. By this point, consultant pediatricians on the unit had begun quietly tracking Letby's presence against each collapse. They raised their concerns internally. The hospital took no decisive action. Babies continued to collapse on Letby's shifts. According to the prosecution's case, Letby had told colleagues she found non-critical care nursing boring, that she preferred the intensity of the sickest patients, the ones closest to the edge. The prosecution's case rested on a single devastating observation. When investigators claimed or examined hospital staffing charts, Lucy Letby was the only nurse who had been on duty for every single one of these incidents. Not most of them, every one. No other nurse's schedule matched. When the chart was displayed for jurors at trial, Letby's column was fully marked. Every other column was sporadic, scattered. The visual was immediate and overwhelming. One name. Every time. What makes this case uniquely horrifying, if the jury's verdict is correct, is not merely that babies died. It's how prosecutors alleged that they were killed. Air injected directly into bloodstreams through intravenous lines, insulin administered to newborns who had no medical need for it, deliberate overfeeding through nasogastric tubes, pushing milk into tiny stomachs until the digestion compressed their lungs and they could not breathe. Breathing tubes allegedly dislodged or tampered with. This is a tough story to get through, especially if you got kids. These are not methods that leave obvious forensic evidence. They do not produce a crime scene that nobody... A crime scene, I guess I should say that, that looks like a crime scene. Every single one of these methods mimics complications that genuine premature babies experience naturally. Air embolisms occur. Blood sugar fluctuations happen. Feeding intolerance is common. Breathing tubes come loose. That, according to the prosecution's theory, was exactly the point. The vulnerability that brought these infants to the neonatal unit in the first place was allegedly weaponized against them. The very fragility that put them in that room was, prosecutors argued, what made it possible to harm them without anyone immediately recognizing what was happening. An audit later conducted at Liverpool Women's Hospital, where Letby had completed clinical placements, added another layer of concern. Records showed that breathing tube dislodgements occurred during 40% of the shifts Letby worked at that facility. That figure was raised during the Thirlwall inquiry and remains part of the broader picture surrounding her career. By mid-2016, the crisis inside the neonatal unit had reached a breaking point. In June of that year, two triplet brothers, children O and P, died. Prosecutors alleged both were killed by air embolism. It was, according to prosecutor Nick Johnson, KC, at trial, one of her preferred methods of killing. Those deaths finally triggered Letby's removal from the neonatal unit. She was moved to administrative duties, not fired, and also not reported to police, but moved. When the full scope of the prosecution's case was laid out at trial, it was staggering. The charges ultimately encompassed 7 counts of murder and 15 counts of attempted murder involving 17 babies. If the convictions stand, it makes Lucy Letby the most prolific child killer in modern British legal history, surpassing even Beverly Litt, the nurse convicted in the 1990s of murdering children at a hospital in Lincolnshire. But here is the part that transforms this from a crime story into something larger. Something that implicates an entire institution. Doctors Inside the Countess of Chester Hospital, had suspected something was wrong long before Lempi was removed from the unit. Consultant pediatricians had identified the pattern. They'd gone to the hospital management with their concerns. They had pointed directly at Lempi. And they were told, in essence, to stand down. Hospital executives did not call the police. They did not suspend the nurse. They commissioned internal reviews. They delayed. And during those months of institutional paralysis, according to the prosecution's timeline, babies continued to be harmed. That failure, that gap between the alarm being raised and anyone with authority actually acting on it is not a footnote to the story. It's the second crime, one that no jury has yet been asked to consider, though the legal system may be moving in that direction. The families of these babies trusted the Countess of Chester Hospital with the lives of their most vulnerable children. Some of those families buried their babies and went home believing the deaths were natural. They were not told about the internal investigation. They were not told about the suspicions. They grieved in private without the information that they had every right to receive. Years later, they sat in a Manchester courtroom and heard a jury deliver guilty verdicts. And even that did not give them the full picture, because the causes of death listed on some of those certificates still read natural or unknown. The families are now fighting to have them changed. The Cheshire Coroner's Court has announced formal inquests. The death certificates of murdered children have not yet been corrected. That is where this story begins. Not with a verdict, not with a conviction, with a neonatal unit in a quiet English city where babies stop breathing, where the staff responsible for sounding the alarm allegedly had their voices suppressed, and where the full truth is still, years later, being uncovered piece by piece through courtrooms, inquiry hearings, and expert review panels scattered across three continents. What happened inside that ward between June 2015 and June 2016 is a question with no simple answer. A jury heard 10 months of evidence and said Lucy Letby did it. A panel of 14 international medical experts reviewed the same clinical records and said they found no evidence of murder in any of the cases. The legal system says she's guilty. The scientific debate says the evidence deserves another look. The families say they need the truth, whatever it is, whatever it costs, however long it takes. And the institution that was supposed to prevent any of this from happening has yet to fully answer for what it did and did not do when its own doctors begged for intervention. That's what we're about to get into. Next, we're going to be going to the doctors, the ones who saw the pattern, the ones who tried to stop it, the ones who walked into executive offices with data in their hands and were told to apologize to the nurse they suspected. Because what happened inside that ward is only one layer of the story. What happened in the management offices above it is another layer entirely, and it may turn out to be the more damning one. This is the story of Lucy Letby, and it is far from over. Love to get your thoughts in the comment section as we work through it. Like I said, it's a five-part series. If you've not done so already, press subscribe wherever you're listening, wherever you're watching. If you're on Apple Podcasts or Substack, hit subscribe there. We'd love for you to join us and also let us know your thoughts. Give us your opinion on this very troubling case. This is a case that we've been reporting on for the last 3 years since it really started going down. And it's a case that's taken some dramatic turns. And even information on this case that's come out publicly on it is dramatically different than what was coming out in the first months and years of the investigation and trial. I'm not here to tell you to believe either way. I'm just going to give you the information as clearly as I possibly can and let you decide. Because I don't know. I do not know. This is a case where literally I do not know. I do not have a stake either way. I'm going to say early on, I was certainly thinking Oh, she had to have done it. The evidence seems to be overwhelming. But when you really get into the nuts and bolts of it, and you take a closer look and you actually hear from the doctors, the investigators, and the people that have looked at this, I think if you're being truly honest, it certainly shakes your confidence in a guilty verdict. It certainly seems that there were some paths that were gone down here in this case actively to prevent certain information from getting out, to make facts seem a certain way. Does that exonerate Lucy Leppe? Does it make her innocent? No. I mean, there are cases where bad investigative work is done, where other elements to a case are not necessarily on the up and up, but they don't necessarily change the actions of a person. It changes more so the ethics of an investigation to get to an answer, when sometimes you can get there without having to weigh the scales down. And I think that's kind of what this case is like. Is this a case where the scales were a bit weighted because somebody or a lot of people wanted to get to a specific answer and they knew the answer they wanted? Did we get to the right one, though? That's a question that I leave you with. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section as we work through this. Substack, YouTube, wherever it is, links are in the description. There's a lot more to come. We'll continue our conversation there in the comments. Then I'll see you in part two. And by the way, if you're wanting to get part two in advance, well, check out our YouTube channel. You can get all of our episodes in advance when you become a member. You can binge away on all of our material, sometimes days, sometimes weeks before we release it to the public. It's a way you can support the show and then get in on all those extras right there. We do appreciate that. All right. We'll talk again real soon. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.